Now we move on to our next guest, Jim Shannon, who was a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army, most notably remembered for creating what's called the First Earth Battalion Manual. Many of the ideas contained in this and other outcomes of putting concepts into practice are, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, featured in this new movie coming out, The Men Who Stare at Goats. And Shannon is portrayed by Jeff Bridges in this film. He calls himself a global strategic designer who believes cultural intelligence should drive the train, not just another economic model. Jim, you're joining us from Hawaii, right?
That's right, George. Aloha. Well,
aloha. There's a good reason to hate you, I guess. You're living in Hawaii.
Yes, go ahead.
I noticed some of the material that was given to me about your background says you have 10 websites, 80 YouTube videos, a Second Life presence, and a handful of books. What are you, a slacker?
Yeah, well, you know, I took that word continuing education seriously. Yeah, I also have 68 skills for which I can receive a professional wage. Yeah, but bundling those together is the secret, George.
I want to talk, of course, about your global visions,
sure.
But because of the timeliness of the movie coming out, I hope we can talk about that for a little bit to begin with.
Much
so people have an idea about your background. What was the First Earth Battalion?
It was a think tank tool, and I chose to create it in such a way that it felt more real. So rather than just having a mission on the board, I walked into the Army's War College one weekend, and instead of giving people a PowerPoint report 30 years ago, I said, "You guys, I want to give you a lesson in states of being, not states of doing. So you guys got to come to the officers club on Wednesday, and I'm going to initiate you into the First Earth Battalion." Well, you know, they look kind of bemused, but what the hell? And they marched after I had prepared the room by turning off the lights, putting on a candle, dragging in a lot of plastic plants, you know, doing my very best as a good shaman to, you know, create the mood, because I wanted them, George, to have an experience, not to have another load of concepts. And lo and behold, after a half an hour, they were dutifully stunned. And I even, you know, ran them up a couple of times, because when we started, I said, "I want you guys to do a mantra with me, you know, a sound of E for the earth. Because we want to intone in such a way as to bring the vibration of the room to a certain level." Well, we started, and they had the most miserable sort of mumbling sounds, and then they all started giggling. But I said, "You know, come on, you guys, this is an initiation. Get it together. You know, you can do this in the military." By the way, the second time it came out of their mouths, the room completely went into a resonant field, and bam, they were there. Told them some stories, talked about the dollar bill, had a colonel get up and do a warrior dance, a Tai Chi kind of a thing, and a Taekwondo thing. And at the end, briefly, I said, "You know, if you see what I'm talking about here in principle, the values that are inside this ceremony, you will recognize that we need to give our soldiers more than things to do. We need to give them things to believe in." And, well, it was okay. They kind of went out the room. The next day I tried to get back in, and the guard outside said, "You can't, Colonel Shannon, you can't go in here." And I thought, oh, shit, I had gone too far. And then the door opened, and they said, "Colonel Shannon, report." And, you know, I know what that means. I marched up like a good soldier and stood in front at attention. They called the room to attention, and they read me my military orders as the mythical commander of the 1st Earth Battalion to go forward in time and dare to think the unthinkable. Now, I almost cry when I remember that. This was an army that was really in need of some creativity and some out-of-the-box thinking. An army just home from Vietnam, very demoralized, very overworked, and now facing a Soviet army, outgunned and outmanned on every level. And we had to do something about that. We had to get bigger than life. And the generals were evidently so happy that I would get out of the box this far that they made me, you know, the Army's basic crash dummy. I say that. Are you still there, George?
Yes, I am.
Oh, good. Just checking. Sometimes these phones are not great. And off I went. And the next time they saw me, I had a 125-page field manual to make the experience more real. And in that field manual were 80 human performance technologies that I had rustled together from being in California at the time and having enough time.
You were doing this on the weekend, right? You were doing it kind of on the weekend of your own, checking this stuff out.
Yeah, and of course it was a thrill for me. I was separated from my family because my wife was a television newscaster in Kansas City, and she couldn't make the trip to L.A., and I filled my weekends with this scouting work. And because I'm a cartoonist, among other things, I packed this all into a manual that the Army then printed. Now, they didn't send it to everybody, but as one of your buddies, John Alexander, said, it became a bit of a cult thing for officers to go to the copy room at night and make a copy of this and give it to their buddies. So it was a sort of an inside thing for the creative folk in the Army. And by the way, there are a lot more than most people know. And off it went. So then, through a series of events with the generals sort of backing this, people all over the Army began to put innovation into their programs. General Stubblebine was one of these guys at the Intelligence Command who required his people to come up with a creative idea every month, and he sponsored that. And what happened when we went to the frontier of what a soldier could be expected to do, or a team of soldiers, we stumbled right into the paranormal. Now, to understand that, you got to recognize that most of us had been, like, I had a rifle platoon in Vietnam, 65 airborne infantry guys, and our job was to stumble into the enemy zone where he lived, fortified himself, and did his job deep in the forest, and basically take his world away, take his village away, take his supplies away, and whatever. Do you recognize walking into that kind of situation on a daily basis?
Yeah, you're not woo-hoo guys kind of tasked by your Army commanders to look into esoteric sort of ethereal ideas. Jim, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I want you to explain what you meant by confronting the paranormal in your research and activities. Stay with us for more of our interview with Jim Channon on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, everyone. We're talking with Jim Channon, who's featured as one of the characters in this new movie coming out, The Men Who Stare at Goats. He's a global strategic designer and is the creator of the First Earth Battalion Manual. Jim, before the break, you said that you sort of began confronting the paranormal as you got into this. What does that mean?
Well, our job in 65, 66, and probably the next 3 years after that, was called Search and Destroy in Vietnam, and that meant we would take our units, move into clandestine areas where the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese were, you know, dug in and operating with their villages in tunnel systems, etc. So our daily job was basically walking into these zones. Now, you can imagine their idea of that was they would have killing zones wherever they could arrange them. They would be dug in, and they would wait for us. So I learned in my very first day of combat, when 14 things happened that, by the way, only two of which I imagined could ever happen, that we had to go completely stealthy. We couldn't talk in English. We had to give signals to each other as we moved with hands, with sounds, with snapping fingers. And we did a lot of talking with our hands. But we could barely see it sometimes more than 30 to 40 feet ahead of us. So what happened was that it psychically, we were extending our awareness into that void. And as a result, and this was true all over Vietnam, certain guys within each rifle platoon would say, "Lieutenant, let me do this. Let me go first. I get this." Because truthfully, they were psychic enough that if they were in the back and they felt what was coming, they nearly went nuts because they couldn't stop the unit. So we got to a place where we never made noise. We could tell when something was about 200 meters in front of us, no matter what. We always stopped. Then we could send small teams up. We could either flush them or go around them. In either case, they would leave the village, and then we could go in and do it in. So that we didn't have words in 1965 for remote viewing. So we didn't even use the word psychic. We just said, hey, John's a great point man. Put him up there. He's willing to do it every time. And it saved a lot of lives. So for the next 318 days of combat, I never had a casualty, and I never had to kill any civilians, and I destroyed most of the villages that I found. And that was just a clue to me then that this kind of psychic ability is properly to be taught to every unit that has to move. In Iraq and Afghanistan, they're going into villages every day. They don't know if there's a bomb awaiting them, a terrorist, somebody wants to incite an activity where there's a big firefight, makes a huge mess, kills too many people. It's stupid. Now we have credentialed the paranormal a little more. We have names for these things. So you take a feeler in with you in Iraq to feel the bomb thing. The belly people can feel the bombs, you know. The ear people, the people who can hear, can actually tell whether a truck is coming at you or going away at a mile and a half. The people who can see have pattern recognition abilities where they can see things that are out of place, and that's where you know there might be a booby trap or something irregular. I can go on, but with this adventure that started in 1978, we were fully authorized to go and find as many of these psychic tools as we could and put them together. Some were used at the national level. Some were used at the theater level. Some were used in the combat units, you know, online, frontline.
So is Project Stargate, the remote viewing program, is that sort of an outgrowth of what you were doing with 1st Earth Battalion?
It is, and it is in the sense that once the Army realized that the big boys, the bosses, were behind this, they all took off in their own special ways according to the jobs that they had to do. So we had a real birth of creativity in the American Army in 1978, 9, 80, that whole time when we needed it. And we put ourselves together to be ready for the Russians, which was the big problem then. And, of course, that whole thing went away, thank God, for other reasons. And we've never really lost the creative edge that happened then. The manual is still moved around in certain circles. And we actually are ready for another creative explosion in the Army right now because they're pretty bogged down right now.
Well, you had mentioned General Stubblebine as being, you know, courageous and adventurous in mind and spirit, and was willing to give you free rein to go after this stuff. But I mean, it, you know, Project Stargate, after they got tired of it, it was widely trashed. You know, we can't really rely on this remote viewing stuff. It's interesting, but not reliable. And it doesn't, I mean, it would be nice to have our troops trained with these kinds of techniques and abilities, but it's not happening, is it?
Well, what would you do if you were an Army and you thought the other side might do the same thing?
I wouldn't get on it.
Wouldn't you say, no, we canceled that program. It's not working anymore.
I see.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing is, what it's led to, George, is just a lot of other refinements related to remote viewing. And when you start bundling the packages together is when you get results. For instance, there were times when I was able to see a Soviet installation from about a mile, and I only had a few minutes to see it, but I could then 4 hours later illustrate every building, the types of antennas, the numbers of windows, and I could do that all because I learned memory techniques. And then I went back and I learned how to draw in 3D. And when I drew the whole complex, an intelligence expert could come in and say, oh, that's a core-level headquarters. This antenna goes 150 miles. that's exactly the number of offices that you need for a corps, because they knew this about the Soviet Army. They knew how many men were in a corps headquarters and what connections they made. So it's the bundle that counts, George, and it's the bundle that's going to determine how intelligence actually happens in the next century or this century. What's in school are categories of things. What we need is to work on our sensing abilities and all of our sensitivity and extending our senses, then work on our logic development in the middle, and then work on our expression out the back end. Are you following that sort of? That bundle of sensing, analyzing, and then communicating may have six skills in it. That's the magic.
Tell me this, as you're traveling through the jungles of Vietnam and you notice that your men seem to have these abilities that develop over time, do they all have it, or is it varying degrees?
It's by type. Some people could learn to walk in the dark, and they actually just turned the job over to their feet. It's really strange. Can you imagine eyes in your feet? Well, they would get, guess what? They got to set up the night ambushes, you know, and they would tell me, you know, Lieutenant, I can do this. Just let me go. I won't make any noise, blah, blah, blah. And if I had had a range of ideas about what psychic was, I'm sure I would have been able to purpose, you know, 5 or 10 of them in different ways. But we didn't have that sort of, funny, if you don't have a name for something, it's hard to talk about, you know?
Tell me this, did you eventually take the formal remote viewing training, or it just was a natural ability that you had?
In my case, I was off doing something else by then. I was designing the National Training Center, which is down in Barstow, because it was my graphic 3D skills that tended to give me the real, that's how I served the Army best. I was kind of like the Walt Disney guy. You heard of Imagineering? You know, when Walt wanted to build something in one of his amusement parks, he would bring in these guys who could illustrate it so well that when they handed the drawing to the engineers, they could build it perfectly. So I would do that with all kinds of Army installations. I would be able to illustrate them. Then another guy would come in and cost. They said, well, that will take 7 people to operate. That'll cost this much. They'll need 2 of those and 4 of these. And so it broke the code down from a word idea into an engineering idea. Anyway, that was one of the things they had me doing.
This movie coming out, The Men Who Stare at Goats, have you been able to see an advanced copy of it?
Oh, I have.
And it's a comedy, right? Is that okay with you and your colleagues?
Well, they sent me the screenplay about 2 years ago, and they said, would I release it? You know, and first time I read it, I went, oh, shit. this is blasphemy. And then I realized, you know, it is so hard to get ideas through the great hairball of information we have out there. I said, no, I'm going to play this game. This is like what we call in the military a meeting engagement, where 2 Army forces run into each other by mistake, and then they have to figure it out on the fly. Mm-hmm. I think I know enough about Hollywood to meet them on the fly. And so I consulted a little bit on the script, worked on the New Earth Army, the logo. They paid me a little money. Yes, it was. And we work hand in hand right now, Overture Productions. And they just did a piece, I think, released 2 days ago that has 4 of the 1st Earth Battalion guys on it.
Yep, we posted it on the website so that people could see it and get an idea what you look like. Stay with us, everyone. We're talking with Jim Channon about The Men Who Stare at Goats and other topics. We'll be right back on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Jim Channon, the creator of the 1st Earth Battalion manual, commander of that unit. They delved into all kinds of really strange stuff, and as he told us at the beginning of the interview, they were quickly confronted by, in his words, the paranormal. When we come back, we'll find out what that means and talk a little bit more about the movie, The Men Who Stare at Goats. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. I'm George Knapp. My guest is Jim Channon. We're talking about the soon-to-be-released movie, The Men Who Stare at Goats. Jim is a central character in this movie, and is featured in the book of the same title. Jim, maybe the telling it the story as a comedy is the way to go in reaching a broad audience as opposed to something dark and secret and mysterious.
Very clever, George. That's exactly how I think. I have a bit of a track record as a shaman, and what I know about getting people interested in new ideas when they're really in love with their old ideas is you have to make a bit of a mess. You take the pieces apart, and then you put them back together another way. So I could smell that possibility here. And John Ronson, of course, sensationalized me in several ways in his book, Man Who Stared at Goats. And then Peter Strawn, the screenplay writer, took all of the parapsychology stuff that had edginess to it and made sight gags and pratfalls out of it. And, of course, I can't blame them for that. Now, you know, if you've seen the trailer, you know that I didn't use black money to buy hallucinogens from my soldiers. Black money wasn't even a word when I was in the Army. And besides, it's a white-collar crime. But nevertheless, then Jeff Bridges checked in with me, and we've had several 3-hour-long conversations about a lot of things. It turns out Jeff, you know, early on studied Alan Watts, you know, and he was involved in the Hunger Project and Werner Erhard stuff. And so Jeff had done somewhat of the same survey of California in 1978 as I have, and since then. So we had a lot of rapport, and I sent him some costume suggestions, et cetera. And anyway, the whole group involved has come together as quite a team. And the movie itself is hilarious. I mean, the sacred cows are spread out all over the battlefield, and the human beings win.
There must have been. I mean, you know, it wasn't funny exactly, the program. I mean, it was a serious effort, but there must have been light moments throughout that process.
Oh, gosh, well, you can't even get in a good psychic state until you're pretty emptied out. So, yes. Oh, and I hope that continues and gets better as we all move into a century where I think, frankly, you know, I did strategic design work for Fortune 100 companies for 20 years, too, after I was in the Army. And I was taking them into the future, and I have to remind people that in 1900, we got speeding tickets for going faster than horses. You know, the highest we'd ever been was in a hot air balloon. And, you know, we only took 3 baths a day. By the end of that century, we were going Mach 14 around Mars. So there was a factor of 100 in terms of the developmental nature of things, mostly because of the capacity builder called factories. We got the assembly line thing done. And it, of course, has colored our lives ever since. And in this century, the big surprise is not going to be that we're going to move ourselves physically faster through time and space, higher and faster, farther. But our sensitivities, our inner space is going to open up, and we're going to actually be, at the end of the century, I predict, actually channeling up to 12 different realities at the same time using this same instrument. Now, that means off-planet connections, on-planet connections, ghostly connections, plant connections, animal connections. And that's a pretty big field to work with. But there are people I know now that work in 6 realities at the same time.
I want to get into all of those realities. But before we do, I want to wrap up sort of the discussion of the movie. Right. You know, obviously the title is a grabber. It's good that Ronson picked that out, The Men Who Stare at Goats.
It's,
I mean,
what
the heck is that about, Men Who Stare at Goats? But, I mean, that happened, right?
Yeah, it did. According to Sergeant First Class Glenn Wheaton, who's a friend of mine, yes, he was present when a goat went down, the first one, I gather. But you got to understand, in the modern battlefield, if you were able to walk up to a village and there was a sentry, and you were able to render that sentry unconscious, not burst his heart, that's a movie trick, but drop him consciously, you can then move into position in such a way as to prevent, you know, a big firefight. So it's a terribly useful tool, and it's a non-lethal weapon, or it can be, just because it happened to so-called kill the goat. It could be used at a lesser effect.
For example, to maybe make yourself invisible as you slip past the sentry?
Well, that's a whole other category from my point of view. But, you know, and Stubblebine, you know, correctly assessed that when you look at reality, it's pretty, there's not a whole lot of meat between the atoms. And that's true for the wall and the person. So walking through a wall, you know, if we get the right frequency pattern right, we should be able to do that.
You had mentioned at the beginning of the interview, as you're exploring different states of higher consciousness, different kinds of realities, that you, in essence, confronted the paranormal. How did that manifest itself? What do you mean? UFOs,
well,
aliens?
Paranormal actually didn't even become an in thing till what, the 90s? You know, public knowledge of the paranormal as a category. So once that word was established and it became a field of interest, it became obvious to me that I should sort of more consciously look for ways to pull that out of the woodwork and put it in, for instance, the military. You may remember that the A-team in Special Forces, there was a communication specialist, there was a language specialist, there was a weapons specialist, there was a doctor, a medical specialist. They could go into a remote area, take over a little town, help the town people out, take care of their medical needs, and build fortifications. And that's how they manned outposts and created them even in Vietnam. Well, let's just take the same set of specialties, except imagine you're in Afghanistan, but you have the kinetic feeler who looks for the bombs, and you have the remote viewer who looks for the ambushes. You have the kind of psychic then that can find a disgruntled person. I'm not even sure what the type of name for that would be. So you have the same set of a similar set of specialties, but the whole idea is to prevent the unit from moving into a killing zone and starting a fight that kills everybody. And you can see that extending your range of awareness it's a no-brainer. It's the smartest thing we could do.
I asked the question in this context, in reading about the remote viewing program, history of that program, and some of the really interesting people involved in it, that as they develop their skills and they're going through the protocols and they're looking for particular targets, places, not knowing what those targets and places are, that they keep running into unknowns, UFOs, aliens, other kinds of consciousness. Did you have those kinds of experiences?
I haven't, but, you know, it's this is a little bit like Dolly Parton when Letterman asked her if she had augmented her breasts. She said, well, I'm just the kind of girl who would. In this case, I have employed on my team here in Arcturus Strategic Design an intuitive consultant who has proven to me that through channeling, clear channeling, I can have certain access to other star systems and people there who are interested in what we're doing here. I haven't been doing this very long, so I don't have a lengthy report for you, other than to say that they have been rebuilding my inner communication system, which is not something that's in Gray's Anatomy, but allows me to project certain kinds of things when I speak, allows me to receive at a greater distance. It's pretty rudimentary at the moment. But little pieces of that connection have... well, for instance, I asked the other day, I said, how many people in other civilizations in the galaxy are actually at this moment in Earth's history helping us move forward? And the answer was, there are 5 entities out there, celestial and otherwise, that are working with every single human being most of the time, and it is through dreams, suggestive behaviors, increasing awareness. It's all subtle. And that's quite a story.
Wow.
And then you go, if you analyze the ancient stories about the end of a cycle, a period, which there are a lot of corresponding stories, and then you take the stories about time compressing. And I don't know how you feel it, but I felt time compressing seriously since the late 90s. It's almost doubling every 2 years, the speed at which we're going forward. By the way, Mitch, you talk, the poor historians have lost it. They just quit taking notes about 1995. They can't keep up with the way the connections on planet Earth are exploding. There are 100 million communications a day between people on cell phones and email and otherwise. Can you picture the buzz of activity that is a reality for us right now? Can you understand that we have actually been a functioning civilization for 30 years? And what I mean by that is, as long as we have a shared culture, listen to the same music, do the same dance, eat similar foods, you know, play similar sports, have popular movie stars that are all the same, and this is, by the way, totally true right now, why is it we don't know we're a functioning civilization? And, of course, the answer is because the leaders are all in power centers, and they don't want to admit that there's anything bigger than them. But something's going to break this one through. And there are all kinds of paradigm shifts I'd like to talk to you about, because as an abstract thinker and an imagineer, see, I don't want to save the Earth, meaning the surface of the Earth. I want to tune people into the biosphere, which is a 7-mile high but very thin envelope within which we all live. So this is as big a shift in thinking as when they finally discovered the Earth was round. That only meant some sailors could finally go home by taking a long trip. But when we all discover the biosphere is actually the thing that needs saving, then it changes everything. And I, of course, wrote Operation Noble Steward, which invites all the armies, navies, air force, and marines of the world to collectively work in their own respective areas to restore the biosphere. Armies working on forests and streams, navies working on overfishing and collecting the pollution there, marines working on inland waterways and coral reefs, air force working on pollution zones from the air and long-range refugee recovery, etc. I mean, this is Jim Channon 30 years after the 1st Earth Battalion Field Manual.
Well, I want to go through that whole list of your suggestions and ideas about the future. Before we leave this part of the conversation, though, you're mentioning of time compression. And there's so much good that comes out of all those communication technologies that you're talking about and the pace of change. But I hate to sound like an old fogey or something, but sometimes I wish, man, couldn't this slow down just a little bit?
As a social architect right now, you know, I've created a vision of 100-year vision for the future of planet Earth, a positive vision, and the key element in pulling it all back together at this point is slow down. So you nailed it. I mean, and as a social architect, we can, and we need a few more social architects, by the way, so we can actually monitor the kind of culture we're going to have instead of the kind of economy we're going to have. Who's in charge of that? But, pace, distraction. The distraction load right now is inhuman. People are not able to embody their soul selves in this level of multiple, you know, your car yells at you, you know, the beepers are going, the phone rings. It's not easy to be present in the midst of all that.
It's almost as if, you know, you look at people, you go to a convention center or something, 50 people come out of a room, they all hit their cell phones talking, you know, there's great technologies for communicating with the rest of the world, and yet it's almost as if people are more isolated because they're so focused on things like that.
Exactly. Exactly. Sometimes it used to be that being in the car on the freeway was awful until they figured out that cars are actually the only sanctuary we have left. if you don't mind going slow and sucking at somebody else's exhaust.
Well, you know, you strike me as an optimistic guy, a glasses half full guy in looking at the future, which on this program in particular, we don't hear much of that. You know, you look at all the tremendous challenges facing the planet,
mm-hmm.
and some of them threatening our very existence, and there's not much to be optimistic about.
Well, it's just who you talk to. I've read volumes of information on basic statistics like sanitation, how much fresh water do people have, how many baths do they take, how many calories they get, everything. Every single indicator of life support has gone steadily up and still is. But people who want to sell you fear are not going to give you that information. We are so close to popping this whole planet right through the roof right now. I mean, people everywhere are ready for us to be one world. They are ready for the internet to be the government, not the power centers. And the internet is already functioning 10 times more effectively to connect ideas and provide services than any government ever invented. And governments, you know, were only a social invention because we knew we wanted to be democratic, but you couldn't talk to people on farms. So we had to invent representatives for those people. And they all gathered around the money pot, and they're just taking it away from us. So we have to walk away from them. And I could even talk about how to do that.
Well, we will get into that. Staying with this theme, though, I mean, when you start talking about one world, man, do you press some serious buttons? Do you do the, you know, especially in this country? I don't know what it's like in other countries, but one world government or one world society or thinking of ourselves as earthlings instead of Americans, people get pretty freaked out about that.
That's my job, first of all, to push the buttons, and second of all, imagine a world laced with three layers of internet and global villages everywhere, so we don't have to travel too far. All arrangements are handled just as they were in the good old commons. It's a no-brainer once you allow the idea in, and we just walk away from these power centers that are being naughty. They're only following the American dream, you know, but they don't understand excess too well. And they also have their own tribes and villages and people that need to go to school. So you can't say all corporate. You know, here's something about corporate people. I asked the question of 12 Fortune 100 companies, the leadership teams, what is your higher purpose? I would not start one of my strategic plans without asking. Never once did anyone stall on the answer to that. They went into it seriously. So it's human beings locked in old systems, but they're not evil.
I would imagine that your reception in corporate boardrooms must have been similar to some of those early meetings with Army brass as you're describing these ideas you have about the future.
Yes, and in both cases, you'd be shocked to know that I was highly received for asking the higher question. Every time. And because I could listen to every one of their ideas and map them on a single strategy board, they were totally thrilled by the end of the session to have everyone represented a direction to go, a higher purpose, and off they went. And of course, the way it in reality what happened is maybe by asking the higher question, I moved the corporation 15 degrees off of its present path. But it's better than whining about those organizations is to get in like the pilot on a ship and just move it a little bit by asking them the higher question.
Jim Shannon is my guest. When we come back, we're going to get into his global strategic designs, point-by-point visions for our future. Stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM. I hope the audience is enjoying this conversation as much as I am. We're talking with Jim Shannon, a global strategic designer. And for the next hour, we're going to go down a list of ideas that he has to shape our future on a global level. I'm going to start with number 11, that we accept the notion that life is more likely to exist in the galaxy than not and prepare for the real benefits of what Jim calls new connections. We'll get into that right after this. Stay with us on Coast to Coast. Welcome back. My guest is Jim Shannon, global strategic designer. Jim, I saved this article. It appeared in the journal Science back in September, And it the headline is human-made crises outrunning our ability to deal with them, scientists warn. And in this article, they talk about pointing to the need for global action on such things as energy, food and water crises, climate disruption, declining fisheries, ocean acidification, emerging diseases, global scale challenges that are outpacing the development of institutions, in particular government, to deal with them. Sounds like exactly what you're talking about.
That's the situation, and of course, all trumped up by the fear-based press systems that we have, and most of all, the last century power centers who are trying to keep their legitimacy by scaring us into their solutions. I've done 7 different global plans, and related to how the heck we get on the right course, I tried to match something we needed to do with a working constituency out there of some kind. In other words, especially what do we do with the people who are not currently employed? Like, what about grade school kids? They're not fully employed. What about middle school kids? What about high school kids? It's what about college kids? And so there's a set of tasks that each of them can add to what they do. Then there's the whole list of things I gave you about the 4 branches of service, each having specific responsibilities at the biosphere level. And so it goes. Every industrial organization has an obligation to make a paradigm shift. And, it's like Ted Turner started the donating thing and then the other people jump on. So there'll be a little bit of, come on, boys, follow us. So, and when I say that, it's not flippant. When I worked for Royal Dutch Shell, as a strategic designer, I had to remind them that almost every tool they had that moved oil could move fresh water. Those kind of paradigm shifts are available, and on some of my websites, they're broken out in great detail, how all those shifts can occur. So we've got our armies involved, the big corporate headquarters involved, school kids involved. Let's leave the working people alone for now. But, by the way, malls that are dying can become new global villages by simply moving the fresh farm goods right in and the entertainment right in, revitalize those elements. And let's see.
Well, so, let's stick with the oil company thing, realizing that they are, you said, liquid transportation companies.
Right.
I'm imagining it's going to take a while to convince them that moving water is a better idea than moving oil, considering how much money they make moving oil.
Oh, a quart of water costs more than a quart of oil. Yeah, I know. But especially if we move into a wideband energy system, which we have to, and just stop relying on 2 or 3 big sources, they're going to have to do something. They can either move into the new sources in a distributed way, but they're going to get it. There's so many ways that oil needs to be saved now. We forget that so many of our plastic implements, I mean, the most useful tools on the planet are like plastic buckets and plastic chairs. They come from oil. So, God, if we run out just driving around, what a crime. But there are equivalent kinds of shifts for almost every type of company that I've worked with. I worked with a Japanese company, for instance, and they said, we are making so much money making this small computer part in that we don't know what to do with our people. And I said, well, just send them home at noon. And, of course, the Japanese women wouldn't have anything to do with that. So in the afternoon now, they change their little white jackets into little green jackets and little green gloves, and they go out and make farm. They have a farm. So they're the first world's birth bifunctional company. So that's possible for workforces. You don't have to send them home or fire them all. You just get versatile about what they do.
I can't imagine what you would do to the Japanese divorce rate if the guys are coming home in the afternoon.
Oh, we would. It would be a bloodbath. I'm pound for pound, the Japanese woman is the most intrepid creature on the planet, I think.
Back to the oil company thing. You're not one of those who buys that we can drill our way out of this.
No, what's happening, my inside information is that the places that still have oil very often are not supported by soil that allows us to get the oil out. We used to dig a hole here, put a pump in, push it, it would come out the other end because the soil stayed in place. Now, evidently, in places like in the Middle East, the sand all gets mushed in with it, and the profit of trying to clean it up on the other end is not good. So, no, and it's just good for our health to move into a diversified power system. I have on my little ranchette here, I have solar, I have a firewood for certain events, you know, I have water catchment, but I still employ the power company half the time now and the water company half the time. So we need to sort of move into that graceful place where they don't have to completely disappear themselves, the big organizations, but share the load. We all move into the country. By the way, rich people, you know what they do when they make a lot of money? They go out in the country and buy an estate, and that's where they could actually survive a crisis. And most of the smart people I know are moving into families of 8 to 12 people. They're all mixed in terms of relationships, but they all have a certain focus on sustainability. My land is 3 acres. I have 12 people. We will be sustainable in the year 2012 because I've got 65 fruit-bearing trees in an agroforest 7-layer system, and they will be coming on with full production next year. And right now we can provide half of the food we need. And we are loving being in the country. I mean, excuse me, I'm going to have to come out of the closet here. I fell in love with planet Earth. Is that okay?
I guess so.
Outside, I mean, before I got your call, I was looking at the 6 biggest trees I have that I've put in within 20 years, and they're huge. One of them's a bamboo stand, and one's a royal palm. And these are for me real deep-rooted objects and foundations of my life. I know my plants. I know I have 70 species on my land. It's organized like a botanical garden and a farm, and you can't tell one from the other. And so we're going to – that's what individuals and families have the option to do, is go back, like Thomas Jefferson said, and help out on the small farm.
How does a family living in the inner city in Detroit or New York or something that has limited resources, paycheck to paycheck living, how do they realistically expect to move to the country or join a commune or do the kinds of things that you're talking about?
Well, they get out their high school yearbook and they find somebody they know that lives in the country. They drive out, make a meeting with them, provide a little money maybe for a place, small place or a yurt or some kind of tent, get a little bit invested psychologically in the land, and then be aware enough so that when the shortages come, they get out of town before everybody else is trying to get out of town. Meantime, they have a lot of stuff growing on the roof. It's, again, like almost every one of the solutions for the future is a wideband solution. It's not this or that. It's this and that. It's just like serial entrepreneurs have turned into parallel entrepreneurs now. Like a fisherman with 5 different fishing poles and different bait on each one, and you still live at home.
You know, you talked about being in love with planet Earth. I ran a search and was looking for other people's opinions of you and your ideas, and I found this blog, a lady who described you as Luciferian.
Yeah,
You're practicing the big lie that you're spreading dangerous propaganda, and uh-huh. I think it's the religious connotation that you would worship Earth instead of God.
I'm aware that God exists, but I just can't put it in an old guy's body with a beard, you know. I'm very spiritual. But the two most miraculous evidences we have that God exists are, first of all, the human body and how it functions, including all the animals, and the planet itself, and the billions of entities that intermingle on the planet magically. Yeah, I don't even know what a Luciferian is, okay? I only heard the word on a commercial you guys had. But if you want to know somebody who's against dogmatic thinking, you know, that would be me. I mean, let's keep the country churches, because that's the best gathering place we have for people in the country. But, you know, shut up from the pulpit, you know. Sing more.
One of the things on your list that I found very intriguing is this one, that we accept the notion that life is more likely to exist in the galaxy than not, and prepare for the real benefits of new connections. You sort of alluded to this in the previous hour when you made reference to these five intelligences. I don't know if that means aliens, if it means angels, something else that we can't quite grasp.
My taxonomy is very preliminary because I haven't been in this world a long time, but I do know that what I gather is there are types of intelligences in the universe that don't have bodies. Then there are types that do have bodies. Then there are types that can change their bodies. There are let me go back to the practical part of this. The practical part is about 5 years ago, right up near my house, they put a new laser system into the telescopes that looked out into the galaxy. And what it allowed them to do was to calibrate the light inferences around star systems and adjust it so that the cameras could take better pictures. And what they found out, and do you know this, that every single star system is surrounded by planets? Did you know that?
Well, I know we keep finding them out there. The list is more than 300, and we just started looking a couple of years ago.
Well, the actual list is now in the billions. Now, why isn't that news out there? It just blows me away. That's almost the biggest event of the century. And it means that every single star or sun naturally somehow either births planets naturally, and that's easy for me to get because stars are mostly dust and heat. And so they could spin off a flare. It could be in the spinning mode. It would turn into like a Christmas tree ornament and heal itself with about 20 miles of skin. And that's exactly how they could be balanced around. This old gravity idea is a pretty basic idea. Most of the ideas I'm getting from the quantum side is that frequency patterns are what hold the planets in place, not gravity. And everything out there isn't a ball of lead, you know. It's very ephemeral, like Christmas tree ornaments, much more, and also way more biological than the academics. Some of the folks I speak with from the other star system say, you guys are stuck in propulsion. You got hooked on the automobile engine, and you can't find any other kind of science that really excites you. And and here's an inference that people, the grown-ups in the galaxy, don't go anywhere in spaceships. They just adjust the frequency pattern and arrive at the place they're supposed to. And these guys around us, perhaps, are, you know, sort of the lower grade outcasts in the system. And I don't think, by the way, they're flying actual ships. I think what they're doing is flying decompression chambers. Because shifting from one location, gravity-wise, is a difference, and they have to decompress. So that's why there are such silly little bowls, you know. They're not very – have you ever seen a really aerodynamic spaceship? I have.
On this program, we talk about UFOs and other kinds of intelligences quite often, and the resistance of mainstream science to even – acknowledging the possibility. I mean, you got mainstream scientists say, yeah, it's possible that there's life out there somewhere. They couldn't be coming here. That's impossible. And they don't want to hear any contrary opinions.
Well, I'm a language specialist, and one of the things I invented to do my job was visual language. So I can assemble a great number of ideas just by using shapes and then making the shapes look like they're going somewhere, and that's what all these corporate strategies look like. Well, when I look at crop circles, of course I can imagine a couple of guys getting together and going out and faking one of these things and maybe getting away with it. But, you know, 1,000 crop circles later, wait a minute, what's their incentive for doing this? They're going to go anonymous and they're going to get up and do this every night? Silly. And what I know by study, I took 64 crop circles and put them out and did a graphic language analysis on them. And there is an art director here. I recognize a pattern of art when I see it, a certain combination. And I think what you're looking at when you look at a crop circle is a verb, meaning this is a picture of a complex process. Now, if you knew what the complex process was applied to, like maybe air conditioning or maybe propulsion, then it would make more sense to you. But if I make a graphic, for instance, of a catalyst that goes on an automobile and a catalytic converter, for example, what happens is something goes in one side, it's changed two different ways, and you see those in the crop circles, two things, two different patterns, and it's probably, hopefully, takes two things away. So a lot of crop circles to me look like catalytic converters or disks inside of high-energy devices. And occasionally you get something that looks like a craft. And then, of course, you get all the orbital dynamics. You know, you've seen all the ones where there's obviously a sun, and the same symbol is used all the time for sun. And then there's a planet over here. Then it shows the gravitational pull between the two. And, of course, the reason they send them to the Earth like that is because they bypass all of the control agencies that won't tell us the truth. And they've told us that they're not going to tell us the truth. But I am really sure, George, as an expert in visual language, that those are verbs. They're sending us advanced ways to see processes. And one of the weakest things about the English language is it has too many nouns and wimpy verbs.
Well, you know, the crop circles aren't even really circles anymore. These intricate designs that, you know, you can see Doug and Dave, the old barflies, taking boards out and creating some here and there, and teams of more intrepid and energetic guys creating something here and there. But the idea that they somehow weave the crops and create genetic changes in the plants themselves, it seems to be a message of some sort, subliminal, appealing to us on a different level. I don't know if they're verbs or not, but it's just letting us know that something's going on that we don't completely comprehend.
Well, I can judge, you know, as an aesthetic person that studies cultures, that these are elegant designs. They're balanced from a point of view, artful design. They're balanced. They're beautiful. They have energy in them. They suggest movement. Almost all of them suggest certain kinds of movement. So there's a common thread that runs through every one of them, pretty much. And we don't get a ducky and a horsey, you know? That's an old joke I remember from middle school. Is it okay? We're looking at the cloud if I just see a ducky and a horsey? Yeah, but no, this is art. It's high-level art. It's communicated in a practical way. Then the crops grow even better the next year. Now, come on. This is not us.
Jim Channon, I'm enjoying this conversation greatly. We'll come back and get into more of your suggestions for a global strategic design. Stay with us, everyone, on Coast to Coast AM. We're having a conversation with Jim Channon. One of the suggestions that Jim makes is that universities build upon the science of conscious evolution, a visionary mindset, and life force, living intelligence, and then structure the experience-based curricula to that end. What does that mean, and do we have time to make the kinds of changes that he envisions? We'll get into that and more right after this. Stay with us on Coast to Coast. Welcome back, Jim Channon. Earlier in the program, you mentioned something about 12 other realities and how some people that you know are able to tap into six of them. Other realities meaning what? Parallel universe, alternate dimension? Is there a way even to describe what it is?
Well, those are two words that continue to work. Interdimensional, transdimensional, wormhole dimensional. You know, all the places that imagine the internet writ large galactically. You know, good grief. So, first of all, the dimensions that are available to us right now are, for example, the botanical dimension. And I know that I can definitely tune in at a certain psychic level with my plants. I can also notice when they are, you know, need something of a certain kind. I can feel them when they're happy. I can look at a tree and occasionally get it to create a wind doesn't come because it's pushed. It comes because it falls into a vacuum. And I can sit there and watch my trees pop wind and, you know, dance a bit for me. Now, I'm just sort of putting this all together and realizing that people who tune into the Davic realms and whatnot are not crazy, you know. They are really hooked up, more than I am. So how about my cat? How about animals? And I swear to God, the other day when I gave something to my cat, it said thank you, and it sounded like thank you. No, I'm
so
sorry.
The men who stare at goats, the men who stare at goats also talk to their cats and their plants.
Yes, my cat and my plants behave much better when I do. Now, I haven't gotten to the chicken that sits on my porch, but I have a chicken that just invaded my favorite chair on the porch. And I'm not sure why she's there, but she worships the beaded necklace that's right next to that hanging off. So then this exposure to the other star system information, which I can't verify yet, but I will know more. My job is to be the scout. My job is to pass back information that, you know, that helps people fill in the blanks. You know, I can come up with the dots. Some people have to color in the lines, but it is completely within range that we will be communicating on many dimensions. People now, of course, on telephone can, you know, say hello, and somebody says hello, and then they say, what's wrong with your liver? Now, excuse me, that's interdimensional. So there is a bundle. I actually have been on Second Life, which is a virtual reality, and met people on Second Life. And just by typing simple questions to them, I actually get a sensation of their emotional state. Okay, that's interdimensional.
Forgive my ignorance. I don't know what Second Life is.
Second Life is a virtual reality that you can access on your computer. I don't know how many million people have been on there already, but it has about 40,000 people a day who inhabit a constructed world, which they build from their computer. They buy land, put up structures, meet other people. But the big thing in terms of interdimensional here is I go on this site, like walking in around a sim site, you know, simulated reality. But there are other people walking around there, but they're from Japan and Korea, and they're live. And their names are above their heads, and you can talk to them. In fact, my friend, one of my teammates, just had a meeting in a Hilton Hotel in Chicago with people from nine nations sitting in a meeting room. Projected on the wall was the Second Life meeting room with 11 people from nine other nations. And the fidelity on the sound was so matched that you really couldn't tell who was in real reality and who was in virtual reality. And the veracity and the depth of the tone of the comments was real enough to assess, you know, emotional state.
One of the things on your list, you say that we should embrace a new level of profound simplicity and reintroduce creativity as a replacement for things and mindless entertainment. I don't know if virtual reality games count as mindless entertainment, but the suggestion is reminiscent of Thoreau for sure.
Well, virtual reality certainly can be mindful or mindless games for some who go in and all they do is build something, which is like having a train set in the basement. But for people who connect with people from other countries and make communication across those boundaries, and when you're talking, you know, 40,000 people a day doing that and all building little islands and they visit each other, like next to my island on Second Life is an Italian island with a casino on it. And when I fly in 6 seconds across to that island and land, I talk to Italians and I can play roulette with them. Now, isn't that an interesting way to mix international relations?
I would make sure I always won.
What's that?
Do you always win?
I'm not really as interested in the roulette as I am in the costumes of the ladies, actually. I'm a fashion aficionado, too. You know, for an old colonel, I'm pretty flexible.
One of your other suggestions, that universities build upon the science of conscious evolution, a visionary mindset, and life force living intelligence, and then structure their experience-based curricula to that end. Is that going to happen?
It has happened in moments here and there. Certainly in California, there are probably 5 institutions you can get a PhD in consciousness. But in this case, I'm talking about practical consciousness. Like, how little does the average man know when he walks up to a woman that he's interested in about actually assessing her energy field, willingness to participate, rapid eye movements, suggestive tone, would he ask before he perhaps held her hand? Is he that awake? This is all about extending all of our processing skills, up-leveling all of our awareness skills. And that is the essential way you go into any problem-solving situation at a multidimensional level. And kids are ready for that. I mean, look at the movies that are popular out there now. Push, Paranormal Something Affair is out. And the kids they're pretty versatile in telekinesis. And I think on Push they had the Watchers and the Bleeders and that, you know. But already actively on that film, there were 4 paranormal skills embodied by each of the 2 teams that were sort of fighting each other. So there's not only a paranormal skill, but 4 of them being bundled intelligently. So anyway, schools are just classrooms full of categories. You know, we have all the categories for science and the categories for history and the activity of actually pursuing something you want to pursue creatively, looking at it, modeling it, shaping it, putting it on the ground. You know, you're just wasting your time in school if you want that. Here's the deal. When we didn't have schools, when we were going across America in stagecoaches, finally when we found a little building and somebody who could read or write and maybe do numbers, we put them in there, made them the teacher. Then all the kids who liked to do read and write and made numbers came back to be the teacher. And all of them came back to be the teacher. It's the same people teaching school. The people who do things, make things, design things, they're not teachers. And that's why teaching at the schools now are just holding zones for kids who have too many hormones or something.
Here's one of your suggestions that I found, and not to be overly critical, but in the realm of wishful thinking, that the national military forces of the planet merge to form natural security teams, restore their respective parts of the Earth's forest, plant life, watersheds, wildlife, the biosphere, above all that. And that's a beautiful vision. But at some level, are we not a warlike by nature, warfare being a fact of human history since before there was history?
Yes, but the least warlike people I know are the people who have already been to war. And they will all tell you that it is unacceptably insane what happens on the front lines today, as it has for centuries. We are in the 21st century. We got to get better than this. And the Hollywood image of people in the Army is a basic training image where everybody runs around and shouts and growls and has no flexibility. I would put a team of lieutenant colonels up against any diplomatic team, any scientific team, any corporate team on the planet in any kind of competition. And it would include lots of creativity. Because let's face it, can you imagine what it's like to be on a battlefield? It is chaos. Pulling that one together requires tons of awareness, tons of pre-planning and thinking. I mean, when I moved my platoon, every time I came to a new place, a new vantage point, I looked at the situation, looked at the cover, the concealment and everything, pre-fought the battle in my mind that might occur, and made my plans for that until I was at the end of that 500 feet and I had to do it again at the next 500 feet. No, people who run army posts, which are the best run towns on the planet, and are separated from their families most of the time and are now in a civil affairs kind of counterinsurgency situation, are only too mindful of how dumb it all is. They would love to be doing something more intelligent and more constructive.
This vision. That government decentralizes into bioregions and organizes military units, school kids, fire departments, and others to generate food foraging forests in all available sites for complete global food security. It almost sounds, I know what people would say to that. That sounds Maoist. You know, it sounds like something
you
on
mean,
a...
because they imagine that armies are already Maoist, that they're run by Teutonic, draconian people who are blunt-headed and not creative. All I really said was, break the governments up, put them in a regional support area, because the four regions of America are highly distinctly different from each other. So when you make laws in Washington, you marginalize all four of the regions because they have different capabilities and needs. And then I actually don't attach my thinking to any more than that, except to decentralize, distribute the talent, and get those people away from the money pot. As long as they can print money, we're in trouble.
And you discuss web-based democracies, dealing with problems on a regional basis. And sort of how the and you also mentioned that the global public achieves this clear unifying identity. That's that would seem to be a threat to every government on the planet, and I would think that you'd have a lot of resistance there.
Well, because they're obsolete. You got to understand, governments were not created by God. They are social inventions. They were very useful for a certain period in history. And before them, you know, provinces and feudal lords were useful. And before that, tribal chieftains were useful. They are no longer helpful. They're actually the problem. Think about who starts wars and for what reason. You can find nations at the center of that. And nations are simply trying to outdo the nation, the government that was before them. I mean, they're not evil people either, but they're obsolete, and they're getting – let me put it this way. George, they're taking up too damn much space. They're making too much noise. They're distracting us from a good life, and they're paying off their buddies. You know, enough.
Well, I doubt you get many arguments from our listeners about that. There are not too many fans of government here.
Well, we hope that those listeners will get off their butts and do something about it, including walk away. Go to the country. Build your survive the way you need to survive. And I'm not talking about the extreme survivalists here. The first step to paradise is called engage your land. And when you engage your land, you learn about water, and you learn about growing things, and you learn about the quality of soil. And if you ever want to get to paradise on this planet, you got to know that stuff.
And I suppose if there isn't enough change, time for widespread change, that in case things hit the fan, that it's not bad to be prepared.
Well, it's good to be partly prepared and then finally convinced by the fan. And at the primary objective of the World Business Academy goal for the 100 years is to see Earth as paradise. Now, there is no doubt in my mind that this Earth is qualified in every regard to be a paradise if we decide to think like that. Yes, and that's going to scare some religious people. Guess what? They're obsolete too. You know, doesn't make them bad. They're not with us. So paradise, in one sense, for the individual, like in my land, is a landscaping job. But if I don't pay attention to the root needs of the trees and the plants and whatnot, it won't be as beautiful as paradise could be. So taking the first step to sustainability puts us on the road to paradise. And heaven, by the way, is just a good mindset. And heaven is everyone's responsibility. Like a city's paved in gold, geez, that's hard on your back. And it scratches the gold, and it wouldn't look like much after a while. And that's about all the religions have to say about paradise. That's not very exciting. They need to go to a real estate course, you know.
The kinds of changes that you envision. I had mentioned at the beginning of this hour the global challenges that we're facing, overpopulation and our inability to deal with poverty and hunger around the planet, at least so far. The kind of paradigm shift that you're talking about, is there enough time to realistically change things around before one or the other of these challenges wipes us out or does some serious damage?
George, I think that the latent ability of people and maybe some galactic support, maybe a lot of galactic support, the common new awareness on the web that everybody has, but it's not been credentialed exactly right. They don't really know they're a planet yet, but that can pop in a fairly short period of time. I think this is a lot like the reversal in the third act of a movie. You know, we are right on the edge of it. And I think universe, creative as she is, is making this push on us to pop us through. And if we don't pop it through by ourselves, then okay, she's going to bring the rest of the galaxy in, and it's going to be an amazing event. And by the way, most of the extraterrestrials we'll see will be former graduates of Earth, for crying out loud. Who else would they be?
What does that mean? What do you mean?
I mean, people who have ascended from lifetimes on Earth and living other places will be the people who come back. They don't all have to be lizards and things and gray things with big black eyes. They'll mostly be former members of planet Earth, our elders, our ancestors. I don't know how we got the whole thing skewed off into little gray people, but I guess it makes for mystery stories or something. But
well, yeah, it's a good story, and maybe it's all of the above. Maybe there are little gray people.
I'm hoping it's all of the above. But I would say the preponderance of the people who would come back to see us at graduation will be our people, our mothers and fathers and grandfathers and stuff. Now, okay, it's a speculation, but I see that we've got a lot of clues that we are in school on planet Earth.
I agree with you.
The school lasts 2,600 years, and at the end of the school, you hope that you've solidified and unified a planet. That would be a perfect ending graduation exercise for the school.
Jim Shannon, hang on. We're going to open up the phone lines and let our listeners ask questions when we come back. Stay with us, everyone, on Coast to Coast AM. Well, I don't think anyone listening to the program would accuse our guest, Jim Shannon, of thinking small. He is obviously thinking big. These are profound ideas, and I think it's fair to say profoundly unsettling, the idea that that we would have a web-based democracy that moves beyond government, that people take direct action to resolve global crises, that they not only move beyond government, but move beyond organized religion, that we start thinking of ourselves as earthlings and raising the planetary awareness as opposed to continuing our warfare ways. I mean, there are some constituencies to whom that vision would seem to be a direct threat and a direct challenge. When we come back, we will open up the phone lines, get your thoughts and your questions on this with our guest. Stay with us for more Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. We're going to the phones in just a moment. Jim, you know, you're talking about a planet-based consciousness, planetary identity, people moving beyond governments. You know, this is profoundly unsettling, and I would think that a lot of folks, a lot of ingrained power structures would see you as a threat. Maybe it'd be easier just to pop you in the head with a bullet from a sniper's rifle than to let you keep talking about it.
Well, I know where I'm going, so they could try if they want. But what do you mean by profoundly unsettling? I think it's profoundly settling, actually, perfectly settling. I think, you know, all old worlds die hard, and, you know, some people just have to say, let's not have a revolution, folks. Let's just walk away. Let's go do what we have to do. Those guys in Washington and New York can get other jobs.
Well, profoundly unsettling in that it is new and it's different. It's radically different.
Well, the speed at which we're going, we have to make some radical turns. And this is a natural turn. This is a turn back into the countryside and profoundly connected by the web, you know, something that gives us answers to our requests in 2 seconds. And that's how barter is done. That's how trade is done. The shaman always, you know, throws the gauntlet down. And, you know, here we are.
About
I'm,
the web.
I'm only sorry that, you know, the level of the discussion here could be 30 minutes an answer, but you're doing good with me. Thank you.
I'm giving it my best shot. But, you know, you talk about the web and the how it connects us all and the instant access to information. It's almost like the Internet has become the Akashic record, the repository of all that we know and all that we will ever know.
Yeah, it's actually a temporary type of consciousness. Remember, when we couldn't get the word around when we were farmers, the reason they invented senators and congressmen was to decide what we were thinking. Well, they're not doing a really good job, and everybody knows it. And by the way, they don't deliver very good services either. So, you know, the web has a lot more, maybe 10 times the value of what we were trying to do when we created a democracy. So I'm still interested in the democracy. I even think venture capitalism, a few pieces of that are really good. But overall, we have entrenched power structures that are being very arrogant and not doing the job. So we just need to leave them alone till they change their mind or go away.
Well, that's what I meant about profoundly unsettling to those power centers.
Oh, fine.
Okay. Whatever. Wild card line. Michael and you.
I've been to war.
Oh.
Michael in Eugene, Oregon. Good morning, Michael. How you doing?
I'm doing just fine. You know, it's like there's so many questions I could ask. It's like I feel honored that I had the opportunity to talk with both of you gentlemen. Gosh, it's just mind expanding here, this whole thing. And it just clicks into what I felt for so long. But how do you get a degree in consciousness? I mean, what is – and that's one question that I have.
Well, you can call Saybrook Institute in San Francisco and look at the curriculum. There are four or five others. There's a John F. Kennedy School of Consciousness, I think, in the East Bay of San Francisco. And they have appropriate courses. They go all the way to PhD.
There was a chair in consciousness studies at UNLV here in Las Vegas that was funded by Bob Bigelow for a while. It caught a lot of flack from other science folks who thought it was too goofy.
Well, let's just take the word consciousness and add the word awareness. What can you use more in your life than awareness? Think about it.
Yeah, Michael, are you still there? Michael's gone.
I've got one more question. Have you ever felt like, I know that I listen to the show quite a bit, and it's like, have you ever felt like, I don't know, it's like somehow you just don't, or you just don't fit in some kind of sort of way? It's like I have hard times sometimes communicating with other people because they don't quite understand what I'm saying. You know what I mean?
And I do, like, in spades.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying?
You can measure a soldier's warrior skills by the medal on his chest, the medals on his chest, and you can measure the change agent's courage by the arrows in his back.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks for the call. West of the Rockies, Richard from here in Las Vegas. What's on your mind, Richard?
Hi, George. You're the best. You hit it right on the head. Jim. How are you?
Just fine. Thank you.
I have your original manual from 1972 that I got through the Shaolin people, which I know you know about.
Yeah.
And all the handwritten stuff and everything, I have a copy of it. And, George, if you knew this, this gentleman wants, by the way, are you higher than a lieutenant colonel now?
Not in the military, but I went through two other careers since then and did okay.
Okay, that's good for you. I'm glad. George, if you knew what this gentleman proposes, it's, there's got to be a central power structure, and what he proposes is setting up warrior people that would be around and control separate sections of cities and parts of countries, and they would all answer to higher beings that would then answer to a central control. And what he wants to implement and what he's talking about is so scary that I knew this day would come when I would hear it on this station, but I never thought I'd hear it from him, and I certainly never thought I'd see a movie on it, and I'm glad it's a comedy. I hope that the paranormal movie does better than your movie.
Well, Richard, but
that's how I feel about
it. That's okay. That's why we're here, is to talk this out. What part is scary to you?
What part is scary to me is the way he, and I don't quite remember, I have the whole manual, but the manual lays out warrior monks and how to train live in tents and in places where you're not ready, where you're not set up to do that, and to get more in line. The original concept of the power was not to kill lambs, but to kill power people like Khrushchev. The way I heard it was Khrushchev at the time, and people like that, so that the people who understood mind control could use that in doing that, in killing those certain people. So there'd be a whole thing. George, I'd really like to get with you just to show you this manual.
Well, I'd like to respond, George.
Sure.
Because if you listen carefully to what I said during this program, my concept is anything but centralized. There is no central control. I'm advocating precisely the opposite of that. Independently operating communities, connected by the web, and having military people with training and skills and equipment doing the hard work to bring the environment back. I don't know where you got the other part about centralized control or people in cities. I don't remember that.
Well, his point about the manual talking about killing people and not just goats, I would imagine that that is probably true in that sense that the Army was sponsoring the research and they were looking for ways to have practical applications in a military sense, right?
No. And nope. That manual is conspicuously absent of anything but how to create peacemaking situations everywhere there used to be a military solution. Precisely.
Richard, do you have the manual in front of you? Is there some part of
no,
it?
No, I don't have it in front of me, but it's not far away. It's buried in a file cabinet.
And you're saying that it was aiming at killing people?
The whole idea was to centralize and coordinate everybody so if they didn't go along with what was going on, they'd either be put in camps, they'd be put, something would be done with them. As he said, really, rather than do something with them, have them trained and put them in with corporations or with the Army or the Navy. I mean, if you're going to have them put in with those kind of military installations, those military installations have to answer to someone.
I really would love to invite you to go to the website neweartharmy.com and get a copy. I think you must have gotten a copy from somebody else. This sounds completely strange to me. And I invite anybody else who'd like to check this out to go to the same place.
Richard, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. First-time caller Chad in Ogden, Utah. Hi, Chad.
Hi. My question deals with something that you were discussing earlier. Jim, you mentioned the biosphere. I've been studying it's called the 13-Moon Peace Calendar, and it's based loosely on the calendar, one of the calendars the Mayans used. Are you familiar with the term? I'm not even sure how to pronounce it. It's spelled N-O-O-S-P-H. ERE, nope.
Yeah, Teilhard de Chardin's Noosphere.
Very good, yes.
Yeah, which is the time when both machines and people would assume a similar consciousness and it would be all over the planet. And he wrote that in 1938, I think. And I am familiar with that, and I have a Second Life website with 38 moons in a giant pyramid where you can read the countdown to 2012 and get preparation advice for local communities.
Thanks, Chad. What's your take on the whole 2012 concern?
Oh, well, if I were God, I would be playing it right up to the last moment to see how willing and awake people would be. You can do the snuff it all out theory. You can do the people of Earth wake up and win the game and the lights come on theory, or you can say this is just another transition from one industrial age to one, and I'm going to use this word, floral age. That's Tom Robbins' word, by the way, the writer.
Oh, I
and on
I
our way to the globe to the golden age.
I know Tom Robbins pretty well, talented writer for sure.
Oh, gosh.
Okay, we're going to wildcard line, Johan in Tampa Bay. Hi, good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, George.
Sure.
And Jim, it's good to talk to you. This sounds like the right plan. You have to use the computers and the internet to do the direct democracy rather than have a representative government. Because the representatives get in there and they seem to get real greedy right away. And I just think it's a great program that you got tonight because it's really hitting at a solution rather than in the midst of our problems here.
Did you have a question?
Does he need a world king to make this system work based on a righteous king?
Well, we definitely need role models, and you know, kings haven't been all bad at that. The nations that use their royal leaders the right way, the royal leaders set a standard, like the Queen of England, etc. They set a standard for excellence, but they don't meddle in the actual day-to-day operations. So, if you're talking about do we need some people to stand up, start be loving beings, bring themselves to nature, have it all come to full life, bring the planetary community together in global villages so we all have the richest benefits of every culture on the planet at a local available venue. Just to say a few things, I love role models. Gosh, we could use a lot of those. I like to see them, in the centers of power. And I wouldn't elect them until I saw whether they could freestyle dance or not.
Thanks, Johan. We're going east of the Rockies. John in Atlanta. Good morning, John.
Hello.
Good morning. How you doing?
Talking to me?
Yes. Yes, we are. Okay. What, you got a question for Jim?
I think a good transition into your program would be, instead of playing all those games with taxes, is to limit profits to like 6%. So, just avoid the whole thing of, people getting aggressive. In other words, if you know that if there was a max, but naturally the more you put out, the 6% of a million is more than 6%. But the thing is, everyone would have a max. And I think this would eliminate a lot of this, putting people like me against you kind of thing, too.
Yep. Competitive?
Yeah. Better than you.
Superior, what?
I'm thinking, in any event, the whole thing is money is ruining a lot of things for people, to make a long story short.
It is. It certainly is. And that's why we recommend what we call wideband ethical marketplace. So you
Well, that's what I was saying, 6%.
Yeah, we have places for money, but we have places for trade. We have places for barter, which is slightly different. We have places for reciprocity, where people just give to each other because it's a principle of love. And we have surplus and exchange. Well, then money takes up only 1/6 of the economic spectrum that way. So you avoid people just ruining the system. I think there was a word, usury, that used to be in the Constitution to take care of people who used the system like they are. Yeah, thank you.
Aren't people, isn't greed sort of come with the territory with humans, that we covet, we want more stuff?
I think it starts, George, with the idea of sort of excellence and goes into efficiency. Then it goes into leverage. And then it goes into, a little more leverage and a little more leverage. And they're doing it, so shouldn't we do it? And it's a slide. It's an ethical and moral slide that happens, especially when you're really producing things in a competitive marketplace. But at the same time, venture capital, which is basically investing in people's ideas and beliefs with paper, allows a country to move forward. So there are pieces of capitalism that are really great. It's basically an extension of belief and faith. It's just the people who get inside and start running the plumbing their own way.
Our guest is Jim Channon. We're coming back. A lot of folks on the phone wanting to ask questions. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM. Back into the home stretch here of our interview with Jim Channon. And certainly no shortage of ideas, things to chew on here, big ideas, big concepts. A lot of folks waiting on the phones to talk to Jim, and we'll get to as many of your calls as we can right after this. Stay with us on Coast to Coast. Welcome back. We have a little bit of time left with our guest, Jim Channon. Jim, you mentioned Tom Robbins. I got to tell you, he's my favorite living author. I mean, wild, crazy, creative. He's a revolutionary for sure. He wrote a book called Jitterbug Perfume, one of my very favorites, and a really interesting take on immortality and the soul. Have you read that one?
Quite a while ago. So you must be more of a mystic than you sound like.
I actually got a chance to correspond with Tom Robbins. He has some friends here in Las Vegas and people who are involved in the remote viewing arena.
Yes.
And so we struck up sort of a relationship by far, but I haven't talked to him in quite a while or corresponded with him, but really interesting guy.
Yeah, I was witness to a showdown between he and Terrence McKenna one time. It was really great.
Oh, wow. I would hope that would be on tape.
Yeah, it is. A lot of Terrence stuff's on tape, not as much of Tom's.
We're going to go to the wild card line, Gene in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Gene.
Yeah, Colonel, it's an honor to talk to you as well as the rest of the Coast to Coast listeners. And I've become an avid listener, and I got a number of questions for you, Colonel.
All right.
One of them is, do you use astral projection as part of your scheme and things? For lack of terminology.
Yeah, I'm not. Say a little more about that, astral projection.
It's out of body OBEs.
Oh. No, but I know that the Robert Monroe Institute did a nice job, and we sent a bunch of generals there at one point. I respect what I've heard about it. I don't myself.
Yeah. Well, also, what I'm wondering about is, this is so fascinating and so enlightening. I would like to learn more about it and how to do these things, like remote viewing and things like that, because, you know, I'm on a fixed income, and I just have to sit and nip and tuck to try to get things to meet. And I'm thinking through this, I can be able to learn more and be more proficient with my life and be able to make something of it, because I hate disabilities.
Sure. Well, you're having some good thoughts about that. I would say the secret is to take the three paranormal skills you seem to like the most and find out how they can work together, and then decide what kind of business application.
Yeah.
And then go for it, because, you know, a lot of it has to do with just pure faith and trust.
Yeah, I need to learn a little more of that.
Gene, do you have a computer?
I got one. I got to get the recovery discs for them, because I got them given to me, and I can get the computer to boot up beautifully. But then he wants a password that I don't have, and I can't get out the rest of the way.
Distractions.
Well, yeah, I think you can. I think there's got to be a way to get around that, Gene. And if you can get on the internet, you can access a lot of the information that we're talking about tonight. Thanks for the call. Going to Mike in Glasswater, Florida. Good morning, Mike. How you doing, Mike? You there?
Hello.
Hi. How you doing? You have a question for Jim?
Oh yeah, I'm in Eugene, Oregon. I thought you said Glasswater, Florida.
Okay, I'm sorry. Well, we've got our lines mixed up here, but what's your name?
Mike.
Okay, Mike, go ahead.
All right, thanks, George. Jim, I just started listening about 41 minutes ago, but I was sort of visualizing a framework based on the Articles of Confederation, which strongly advocated state rights over a centralized authority.
Mm-hmm.
And then including aspects of the Constitution dealing with individual freedoms and state rights. And then each region or state would coin its own currency of exchange backed by substance as opposed to fiat.
Right.
Then there'd be monthly votes on clear-spoken, complete, single-issue legislation as opposed to the sort of, you know, legislation filled with hundreds of issues and then the additions they always make to it. And then there would possibly be a regional leader or governor elected every 4 years, but whom voters could raise a fair referendum to remove annually. This would all be written down and physically tabulated. My problem with what I've heard you say, and leading to my question, is we already have four corporate horror stories with the current black box voting. I think we should go back to written votes that are hand counted. It's been established it is fairly efficient and involves the communities. I would never trust internet voting. If they're immobile, a voter, they can send in a paper ballot. My question is, do you really think that we could trust anything with loopholes galore?
Well, if you noticed, and we completely agree about the idea of decentralizing, first of all, and printing state money, that would take the huge monopolies out pretty well. And I like the bundle of conclusions you came up with very much. I don't think I have enough time to talk about the Internet in terms of its real deal-making power, but you look at Craigslist and whatnot, and it is handling local commerce exceedingly well built in. So I think the number of laws that need to be made regionally and the number of potentates or head people we need to vote for should be highly reduced. We should reward them based on their ability to deliver services, not the president of the senior class.
So you're saying we wouldn't necessarily have an election online.
And not to have too many elections be, people could be put in that job based on meritocracy. Yeah, I think the entire business of expecting some person somewhere or some group of people behind closed doors to help us decide how to do our interactions with each other and our deals is old-fashioned and out of date. We need to rely on people figuring it out for themselves, just like everybody's got to decide where their heaven is. It's a personal responsibility.
Thanks, Mike. I'm sorry.
Good stuff, Mike.
Thanks. Good issue, Mike. Thanks for the call. East of the Rockies, Mark in Lansing, Michigan. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Bill. I was just wondering now, I've worked on like a lot of stuff like this. I was thinking like if I could get enough people to learn like a given like skill, like any of the paranormal skills that you're talking about, it would kind of pass the 100 monkey mark, you know, where everybody would have it.
Right.
It would just kind of be common knowledge to the ability set of the species. That being said, like, you know, I've seen several people who are actually working on these types of issues and are doing a lot of the same stuff you're doing. But I really appreciate what you're doing because there seems to be a leadership effort in that. But what is your organization based off? I mean, like, where does it start, you know?
Well, first of all, my organization, which sounds like a unit in an army, a battalion is normally 600 people, is a name for actually a think tank process. It's not actually an organization somewhere. And so what we do, though, is by associating the ideas with a type of organization, they become more real. But we don't have a headquarters, and we don't, you know, have control of any units anywhere. With respect to the note about getting a group together, I know the people at Fairfield, the Transcendental Meditators we have two colonels in the Army that are studying the principle of putting 1,000 people near a village that is dangerous and meditating at a certain level of coherence, which means like clear mind, and it would reduce the level of resistance. And so there's an area where if soldiers had that skill, and right now it's a little too difficult for the average soldier to spend that much time being a city, we could employ that kind of mind field, if you would excuse the phrase. And, you know, before we enter, the whole secret about entering dangerous areas is to do it in a way that pacifies as you move. And that's why we suggest certain kinds of music, even sending a robot vehicle in the night before to show what the force is going to do when they come in, like fix the water system, et cetera. So, well, I appreciate your thought.
Thanks for the call, Mark. West of the Rockies, Chris in Diamond Bar, California.
How you doing, fellas?
Okay.
All right. So, hey, I was wondering, great show tonight, avid listener, as much as I can anyways. I'm just curious as to, I've heard Jim mention God more than a handful of times, and I'd like to start off and say that, you know, I am a Christian, you know, I believe in God, And I avidly study the Bible, and to the King James Version, to be specific. And I just wanted to say that these all sound like great ideas, you know. But it's really wishful thinking in vain. Just to say that, you know, that the earth, we can make it like a utopia, and that heaven's a state of mind. You know, heaven is a very real place. And you said something about being paved with gold, and that would be bad on your back. Yeah, I agree with you. But, you know, if you said earlier that God, there's evidence for God with the creation of the body, and that we have, you know, all the animals and then the earth itself. That's great evidence. Obviously, that's obvious evidence that God exists, and that means God's powerful. Well, if God's so powerful, what is to say that he's not in control of his word that's given here on earth for people to read? And that would make our God impotent if he gave us the word and it's been adulterated over thousands of years. That would make our God impotent, and that would also make him not able to create anything. And realistically, it would eliminate a need for any such God. Then that would all make us be, you know, just a complete accident, which is preposterous and ridiculous. I just want to hear your thoughts on what you think God is.
Because wow. I'm confused.
God is the force that is everywhere, that is unseen and sort of semi-unknowable by us, but the evidence of such a presence and such a deep intelligence and such a wonderful design is inescapable. Tracking a mythology through 2,000 years in a written document prepared by man gets a little tricky for me to handle, especially when I've studied 9 other religions, and I find that the common big ideas are all quite coherent and alike. It's just the details. And I'm not too impressed with the Christian version of the future. What's happened in our lifetimes is that men and women of vision and clarity of vision have always produced the impossible. And I'm saying, let's take this planet up, this beautiful planet up, on its basic setup, and our beautiful minds, which need to be released from data and put into a creative mode, and go for paradise as evidence to the Creator of our appreciation and love for what has been given us already.
Thanks for that call, Chris. You would say then, Jim, that God is a big picture sort of entity, intelligence, as opposed to a details guy?
Even more than that, I think God is more like a galactic energy field in which we actually participate in the construction of the magic that appears. So God is, in that sense, pure potential. And you know, this is somebody who's looking at the edges of things. But I know that I'm not getting very far with the dogma and the doctrine. You know,
We're just talking. That's why we're here.
Yeah, sure.
First time caller, Maura in Madison, Virginia. Hi, Maura.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Good.
I envision a change in military uniforms down the road. I know it's going to take a while because right now, I think I agree it's insane, this warfare and sending our young men and women into areas to destroy a geographical area and then the after effects. But I called the Fashion Institute in New York and a few other fashion schools and whatever, and I thought it would be a great project for the students to design a military uniform on the life-giving plus side. Not
yes.
As an invader, but as a repairer, to go in and help where the people are starving, where there's no water.
Mm.
Help with, and maybe a blue denim or plaid or just something. And the reception that I got was, what? You know.
Yeah, I understand. But I've also designed such uniforms with the same thing in mind. And especially, I have 3 people working on music that can be played to pacify. And my color is a gray light aqua. But, you know, people, good grief, they snickered at me for saying things like carrying lambs with you. Oh, boy, the snicker factor was really big on that. But, you know, we're talking about regular people in a battle zone, and we have to stick to pretty common things of of that are peaceful. And soldiers, the soldiers that I know had no problem with uniforming themselves in order to enter danger areas and whatnot. So thank you. I think you're on it. And don't be discouraged and, kick the system into action.
That's an interesting thought. I mean, soldiers going into an area wearing a less hostile sort of a uniform or carrying a lamb or something, it would seem to have practical benefits in that somebody is less inclined to shoot you.
I know it's so different than, for instance, the movies that we've watched for 50 years. But, yeah, that was in the field manual, precisely. And John Ronson, he actually picked up on it in the right way. He got you must make a gesture of love if you want trust. Because people are so trigger-happy when they're scared and threatened. And that's what gets groups of civilians in the melee. That's got to stop. We got to beat that. That's no good.
Wildcard line, David in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Hi, David.
Hello. My point previous caller was, sir, I was wondering, you do make distinctions between communism and what you hope or aspire for the government to be, because when you touch on eliminating ethos of competition, you take away, you start developing ideals of communism, where for former country of the USSR was in competition with the U.S., but its individuality and part of its falter was it took individual accomplishment out, because everybody was the same. If you could produce a profit margin that everybody has, and there are benefits of communism where it may help prevent poverty as much, because everybody's on equal income levels. But I hope your writings, I haven't read anything you've had before, so I just hope you distinguish between what you inspire to have versus a communist state. Mm. And the second point is, I just heard you talk as what will be with God the Creator, with man's interpretation over thousands of years ago when the Christian Bible was written, and or the Quran, that man's interpretation of what a day is and written as the world, the universe, our universe, was created, our world was created in a day in less than 24 hours.
Hey, David, we're out of time here. Jim Channon, I have really enjoyed the conversation. I hope you didn't misinterpret some of my questions or comments about your statements being profoundly unsettling. I meant they were unsettling to power structures and organizations.
Yeah, well, but again, and I have been in both. I lived in those worlds, and every time I asked them the highly purposed questions, they always acknowledged that was the thing to think about. So. I'm not afraid of them being unsettled.
All right, Jim, I really enjoyed the conversation. Hope we can communicate in the future. Thanks, everyone. I'll be back next month on Coast to Coast AM. Have a good one.